Forces is now open and in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Grading. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Christina Riggs, and I represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Christopher Grading. Chief Judge Eflin, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
May do so. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be presenting my argument in two parts. The first part will focus on why it was error for the military judge to refuse to recuse himself when requested to do so by the Civilian Defense Counsel. The second part of my argument will focus on why setting aside the findings and sentence is the only appropriate remedy in this case. Justice must satisfy the appearance of justice. This is the often repeated reasoning courts use when determining whether or not a judge should have recused himself under 28 U.S.C. 455 Alpha, the federal statute which echoes the purpose and language of Rule for Court Martial 902 Alpha. Rule for Court Martial 902 Alpha requires that a military judge recuse himself or herself whenever their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. As found by this court in United States v. Butcher, by requiring recusal whenever there is an appearance of bias, not just when actual bias exists, Rule for Court Martial 902 Alpha helps to enhance confidence in the fairness of the military justice system because in matters of bias, the line between appearance and reality is often barely discernible. In this case, the military judge created the appearance of bias when he spoke to the staff judge advocate and the staff judge advocate's deputy, not only regarding...
Was that raised at trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the conversation with the SJA raised at trial as a basis for recusal?
It was raised at trial during the voir dire. During the recusal motion, the civilian defense...
I thought the basis for the recusal motion was his sitting on the companion cases.
There's an interpretation of the record which the government does argue that the basis for the recusal was the military judge's presence on the companion cases. However, in reviewing the record, the fact that the motion for recusal came just after the voir dire regarding the conversation with the staff judge advocate, and the civilian defense counsel makes his motion, he says that given your presiding over the companion cases and the nature of that involvement, which is arguably an ambiguous basis for the motion. Also, in the 10 May 2004 letter of the Civilian Defense Counsel to the convening authority requesting clemency on behalf of the accused, the Civilian Defense Counsel points to the error of the military judge and specifically says, we made a motion to recuse the military judge based on his conversation with the staff judge advocate and his view that PTA and staff judge college case was too light. So based on that, it's the only reasonable way to interpret the record is that the conversation with the staff judge advocate was the basis for the motion for recusal.
Is that essential to your argument?
I don't believe it is essential.
Why not?
Because the motion was made and the judge refused to recuse himself. And it's not essential that the Civilian Defense Counsel cited a specific basis. It's essential that the Civilian Defense Counsel made the motion.
Counsel has to do is say motion to recuse for whatever ground might be relevant?
No, I believe he has to cite some basis for the grounds. So I believe in this case, I believe that the facts make it clear and the record makes it clear that the basis for the motion was the conversation.
Does that mean that if Civilian Defense Counsel said nothing at all, but the military judge had, making up new facts, had discussed the case with the trial counsel beforehand and knew he had discussed the case with the trial counsel beforehand, but there was no motion to recuse, the military judge would not have a duty to recuse nonetheless?
No, I believe that they would need the facts on the record to support the basis for the motion. I believe if the
judge would not have an independent obligation to recuse himself if he was aware of something that would warrant his recusal?
No, of course he would.
How can the counsel waive something that would otherwise require a judge to recuse himself?
The counsel did not waive it. It would be a determination. It wouldn't be essential to my argument. It would be essential to whether or not it was an abuse of discretion, whether or not the motion was made and the judge had an opportunity to refuse it and the record supported it would be an abuse of discretion, whereas if the motion was not made with the basis just simply arose, it would be maybe a plain error review.
Counsel, why don't you just proceed on the assumption that none of this was raised by the motion, and the facts are the facts that we have now before us.
Yes, Your Honor. And the facts that the court has now before
us. Not asking to concede that, but make the argument on that basis.
Yes, Your Honor. And the facts that the court has before us is that the military judge did have a conversation with the staff judge advocate. And during that conversation, the military judge advised the staff judge advocate that in the case of a related companion case involving a co-conspirator of the accused, whose court martial the military judge had presided over, the military judge told the SJA that that case, the PTA, had been sold too low. And in citing why the case was sold too low, the military judge specifically commented on Staff Sergeant Caldwell's level of culpability, the severity of his conduct, the effect that his misconduct had on junior Marines, and the effect that his misconduct had on the security of the installation. Each of those four factors was also present in appellant's case. And so by implication, the military judge was not just commenting on a past case, but he was also commenting on appellant's case, which was pending. The military judge also acknowledged that he knew that the case of appellant was pending, and that during that conversation, the staff judge advocate advised him that appellant's case was pending. However, it is not necessary even to make the inference that the military judge was discussing appellant's case, because during that conversation, the military judge also specifically referred to appellant. He cited that the conduct of the junior Marines was less culpable and questioned their referral to a special court martial because they had been guided by a misguided sense of loyalty and dedication to the two staffs and COs. The only two staffs and COs in the circumstances and events of this case were Staff Sergeant Cardrell and appellant. So the only person that the military judge could have been referring to in making that comment was appellant.
Counsel, with respect to the sequence, can we determine from this record whether the conversation with the staff judge advocate took place before or after the accused entered into a pretrial agreement with the convening authority?
The record is unclear as to specifically when the conversation occurred. However, the record does support in the staff judge advocate recommendation at Joint Appendix 17 that Staff Sergeant Caldwell was convicted on 16 April 2003. The pretrial agreement was signed by the appellant on 23 September 2003. It is reasonable to assume that the military judge, since the conversation was premised on his frustration with Staff Sergeant Caldwell's trial, that occurred immediately or soon after Staff Sergeant Caldwell's trial. So it's reasonable to assume that the conversation occurred before the pretrial agreement was negotiated in the appellant's case.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the basis for that inference in terms of the sequence.
The basis, I'm sorry, sir, I'll state it again, is that Staff Sergeant Cardrell, the record is clear from the Staff Judge Advocate recommendation, we know that Staff Sergeant Cardrell was convicted on 16 April 2003. This conviction is what prompted the military judge to have the conversation with the Staff Judge Advocate, apparently from the record, since the military judge was commenting on specifically Staff Sergeant Cardrell's trial. It would be unreasonable to assume that the military judge waited several months after the trial before having that conversation.
Do you have the record before you?
I have the record right there.
It might be useful if you could specifically, in responding to Judge Efron's question, rather than characterize the record, read specifically what in the record you're relying on for your statements. Do you follow?
I do follow, sir. I'm not sure what specifically in the record I could read from to respond to the argument. I can only respond to the dates that certain events occurred and make a reasonable inference from there. Because there's
so your inferences are solely drawn from dates.
They are, sir. There's no specific notice. There's no specific comment in the record or any indication as to when the conversation occurred.
Because if the conversation took place after the convening authority and the accused entered into the pretrial agreement, that might have a bearing as to the nature of the prejudice in the case. Because if the conversation took place before the pretrial agreement, then the defense would have an argument that the convening authority entered into the pretrial agreement with advice from the staff judge advocate having an assessment from the military judge as to the type of sentence that the military judge might impose.
Yes, Your Honor.
Whereas if it took place after the agreement was set, what argument would the defense have as to prejudice on findings?
Assuming, again, the defense does argue that the conversation took place and that that's a reasonable inference from the record. However, even assuming that the PTA was negotiated prior to the conversation between the military judge and the staff judge advocate, the prejudice on findings, there is still an argument as to why there is prejudice there. And looking at prejudice, and we look at the risk of injustice to the appellant, which is the first logic factor. The judge is required to exercise discretion in determining the findings.
Well, in this case, he pled guilty, so the military judge isn't, quote-unquote, determining the findings, is he?
He has not. It is certainly a lesser degree of discretion than it would be as if if the trial were contested, but the judge still has discretion whether or not to accept the pleas. In this case, the military judge specifically did not accept the plea to obstruction of justice. There was, during the provenance, he raised an impossibility defense toward the dereliction of duty charges, and the judge exercised discretion to accept those pleas. We are not here arguing that it was error for the military judge to accept those pleas. However, it also, based on the record, would not have been error for the military judge not to accept those pleas because of the impossibility defense that was raised. So the judge did exercise... I'm sorry, sir.
I thought you were done. Are you done with that? Go back to, before you get to prejudice, you've indicated the only indication in the record, if any, as to the timing of this discussion was the dates themselves. Now, the military judge says on the record on page 20, yes, I routinely give a post-trial critique to counsel following a trial. I would have talked to them about it then. I also talked with the staff judge advocate and probably his deputy, not about this case other than that it was coming. It was coming. They mentioned it was coming, but about the other cases. And then they go on to discuss the thing about lowballing it and all that. There's nothing that might be inferred from this, and I would ask the government as well. That seems to suggest it is on or about the time that he had the discussion with the counsel.
It would suggest...
Why not?
It would suggest because the trial, because it was coming, suggests that it had not come before this judge yet. And since the accused was, appellant was arraigned on 11 August 2003, it would indicate that the conversation occurred before his arraignment, which would also be before the pretrial agreement was signed by appellant. So I thank you for reminding me of that.
How can you tell from the date of arraignment when the pretrial agreement was signed by appellant?
I'm referring to the fact that the date of the pretrial agreement was signed is reflected on the pretrial agreement, Your Honor. As to the other areas of prejudice and the other factors that would require setting aside the findings and sentence in this case, other risks of injustice to the accused, there are other areas of discretion which the military judge exercised in this case. The one was, of course, the sentence awarded by the military judge. It was completely within the military judge's discretion, subject only to the maximum punishment, what sentence he would award in this case. And also, the diatribe against appellant that the military judge included on his announcement of sentence. Although that statement has no legal effect, it was included in the record of trial and may have affected what clemency was granted by the convening authority. The military judge, of course, had discretion to determine whether or not he should give that diatribe at his announcement of sentence.
Wasn't sentence substantially below the cap in the PTA?
The sentence was 6 months.
And the PTA was 15, right?
The PTA was...
Where's the prejudice on sentence?
The relevant comparison is not what the military judge gave and what the PTA was. The relevant comparison is what a judge who was not biased against appellant would have given. And
are you maintaining it was an actual bias?
I am not maintaining it was actual bias, and the appellant continues to argue for apparent bias and not actual bias in this case. However, given that the defense requested no punishment, a reasonable observer could conclude that a six-month confinement was an act of prejudice.
Can you do a quick side-by-side comparison of factual as well as legal on Cadrell and appellant? Were they both staff NCOs? What was their relationship in the facility? And then what did Cadrell get, et cetera?
Yes, Your Honor. Staff Sergeant Cardwell and Staff Sergeant Green were both staff NCOs in the facility at the kennels.
And they're both staff sergeants.
They're both staff sergeants. Yes, I'm sorry, sir.
That's all right.
They were both staff sergeants and had the same date of rank. One was not senior to the other, except that Staff Sergeant Greeding, by virtue of his position as the kennel master, did have positional authority over Staff Sergeant Caudrill. Legally, Staff Sergeant...
Were there other staff NCOs at the kennel, according to the record, or were these the two staff NCOs?
These were the two staff NCOs, according to the record. As far as comparison of their charges, Staff Sergeant Caudrill had a charge for drinking while on duty that... that the appellant did not have. He also had a charge for assault that appellant did not have. Appellant admittedly had a charge for use of marijuana, which Staff Sergeant Cardwell did not have. Staff Sergeant Cardwell received a PTA with a cap of confinement at 75 days and was awarded a sentence of 4 years by this military judge at his trial. Sergeant Sergeant Green.
And what did he get on clemency?
The record is unclear whether or not he was he was not granted any clemency.
No clemency, so he ended up with 75 days?
He did.
Appellant?
Oh, I'm sorry. Appellant was received a sentence of 2 years from the military judge. He was, he received a sentence of 6 months from the military judge. The PTA was for 15 months. In an act of clemency, the community authority reduced his confinement to 90 days. In citing his reasons for granting clemency, the community authority did not cite the military judge's refusal to recuse himself. He cited the tradition of granting clemency during the holidays. The date of the grant of clemency was 21 November. As to other factors which necessitate setting aside the findings and sentence in this case is the second Lillijohbrook factor, that is the risk to injustice in other cases if the court were to not set aside the findings and sentence in this case. In this case, the military judge had an improper conversation with the staff judge advocate. If this court were not to set aside the findings and sentence, it could be interpreted as even the court giving its tacit approval to that misconduct. And that would threaten the independence of the convening authority. The independence of the convening authority is a necessary and integral part of a military justice system. I assume my time has expired. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Your Honors, and may it please the court, my name is Major Brian Keller, along with Colonel Lewis Perullo. I represent the government in this case. Appellant, in a sense, conceded this case when at trial he conceded that the military judge was, in fact, impartial. No reasonably prudent person, in light of that fact, in this guilty plea case, could find this military judge to be anything other than impartial. Moreover, the military judge here did not abuse his discretion in declining to recuse himself when he fully disclosed matters in the record, was voir dire, and where the lower court affirmed the sentence as appropriate. The government will note that with regard to the staff judge advocate conversation and the scolding the Marines for scolding appellant for leaving his junior Marines, that was not specifically objected to on the record.
Is it in fact the government's position that such side conversations with the staff judge advocate constitute private conversations and therefore have added military judges? Your brief makes the argument that this was a private conversation between the military judge and the staff judge advocate. Is it the government's view that it expects its military judges to have private conversations with staff judge advocates about pending cases?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Taken alone by themselves without any other context in the case, which of course is the test, that the reasonable observer knows all the facts and circumstances.
I'm arguing a factual question with you, not the legal ramifications of it, but in your brief you say, don't worry about it, it was a private conversation. Can judges have private conversations with staff judge advocates about pending cases or cases that they've just heard when they're talking to one side or the other?
Well, it's a completed case, Your Honor. So in this case, it was a factual observation about what just occurred. So is it
the government's view that it had no repercussions or implications for a case in the future?
In this case,
putting aside the prejudice argument and all that.
Well, the first words out of my mouth were no. I mean, this is not the government's position that this is an okay conversation. Taken alone by themselves, this looks bad. But, for instance, if the military judge then saw...
But in your brief, you argue that this was a private conversation, and therefore we should not be concerned about it.
Well, Your Honor, taking all the facts and circumstances, that is one of the factors here. It was a private conversation. By themselves, if the military judge...
And my concern is if the government is of the view, and the government, not just you, the litigator, but the United States government of the view, is that this is somehow off, not of concern because it's a private conversation, that's a pretty odd standard to set for military judges who are supposed to be independent.
Your Honor, that's not a standard of law that the government's espousing. It's that this particular conversation was a private conversation. The military judge was saying, I gave 12 years and you gave 75 days. That's a factual observation about the disparity there. Is every private conversation okay with the military division of convening authority or staff judge advocate? Obviously not.
Well,
these look bad.
What is it about a secret conversation, a secret ex parte conversation between the military judge and the staff judge advocate that makes a conversation that would otherwise probably be improper, proper?
Well, there's nothing about it except the fact that it's a conversation between two military officers.
No. It's a conversation between the government and a judge. It's not a conversation between two military officers. You can't take... The context that we're looking at here is an impartial military judge having an ex-party communication with the government. And what is it about the fact that that was a secret conversation, as you argued in your brief, makes it appropriate?
Again, Your Honor, it's all the facts and circumstances of this case. The reasonable person looking at the fact that the military judge had this conversation when the appellant did not object to trial.
Is it appropriate for a military judge to have a conversation with a staff judge advocate as to the sentencing limitations and pretrial agreements where other cases are yet pending?
No, Your Honor. And again, that's why the first words out of my mouth were no. The government is not saying that this is an acceptable conversation, that this is a good...
Then why didn't the judge recuse himself? If it's not acceptable, why didn't the judge have a duty to recuse?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the test again is, there are two tests. Of course, Campos says that where the military judge divulges the grounds is available for voir dire and there's no prejudice. So that says the 902's concerns are met. And in this case, of course, there is no prejudice. The other test is that there's such a high degree of favoritism or antagonism to make fair judgment possible. If the watchwords in this case are prejudice and whether fair judgment is possible, certainly that occurred in this case.
Why wouldn't we apply the same standard that we apply for members in the implied biased context to a military judge?
Well, and that's why it's significant that appellant did not object here on the record on grounds of actual bias. Appellant said, we're not saying that the military judge is actually biased.
No, I'm talking about implied bias.
But it's significant in this case that appellant said, I don't think that the military judge is actually biased. And that's because there's a difference between the test for members and the test for judges. For the members test, as the government understands it, it's whether a reasonable member in that member's position would be seen as being biased. Certainly, whether if the member's wife was murdered, it's a wife murder case, then it doesn't matter what appellant says, whether he thinks he's biased or not. But in this case, appellant on the record says, or his counsel on the record says, we're not saying that the military judge that you are actually biased in this case, and that makes a difference. A member of the public looking at a guilty plea case.
And what's the difference with that and the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process?
I think that goes towards that, Your Honor. If appellant stands up and says, I don't think there's any actual bias in this case, a member of the public then looking at this court-martial is going to say, well, appellant clearly said that he doesn't think there's actual bias in this case. I don't think there actually is bias. And, of course, applying the Campos standard with regard to prejudice, you've got the military judge, you've got a 15-month pretrial agreement, you've got a 6-month judge sentence, and you've got 90 days clemency. Taken in light of all the facts and circumstances, looking at Staff Sergeant Cadreel's pretrial agreement, which was for 75 days when he was the first one to plead guilty, an appellant who, about a half year later, I suppose, pleads guilty and gets a 15-month sentence, but nonetheless, a 15-month pretrial agreement, but nonetheless gets a very short, a different pretrial agreement than gets 90 days on clemency, it's fair. Justice has been served in this case. I mean, add to the fact that, as I was saying, the government didn't point out correctly, but appellant did not actually raise the staff judge advocate's conversation as a grounds for objection on the record. It wasn't until the Mayo 4, I believe, clemency submission. And even in the Mayo 4 clemency submission, despite the way appellant characterizes that clemency submission, what appellant says is it was merely a conversation visiting the staff judge advocate to complain about the modest ceiling on the punishment of confinement set in the Staff Sergeant Cadrillo's case. Nothing about the junior Marines, which is what appellant now on appeal alleges is the
case. Would you agree, as a matter of law, not as a matter of fact, that regardless of what defense counsel argues or fails to argue, if in fact, which is not your argument here, I understand, there is a basis for a judge to recuse himself, the judge has a duty to recuse regardless of what defense counsel is up to?
Yes, Your Honor, under MRA 103, if it's reasonably apparent from the record, the government's, with regard to the...
Now, I'm not trying to back you into anything in this case other than to make sure there's not a difference of view there.
Oh, no, no.
On the law.
I don't think that this is reasonably apparent from the record that this is grounds for recusal. Taking over.
But had it been, then it doesn't matter whether the defense counsel is arguing it or not.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Then it would be abuse of discretion.
Counsel, in that regard, can we finish, Judge Weiss? In that regard, in Campos, was there a ground for recusal that was either actual or based on either actual or apparent bias?
I do not believe that there was, Your Honor.
Okay, so what difference does it make whether the judge disclosed it or not? Wasn't the court simply saying this is an extra consideration here as to the issue of confidence of the public? Is there anything, Campos, that stands for the proposition that a judge can disclose disqualifying information on either actual or apparent bias to the parties and force the parties to make a motion for recusal at trial?
I didn't follow the last part of your question.
Can a judge, what case stands for the proposition that a judge can disclose on the record grounds for actual or apparent bias to the parties and force one of the parties to make a motion for recusal at trial rather than the judge recusing himself or herself?
I don't think there is a case that the government said.
And are you familiar with the practice in federal district court as to what happens if a judge makes such a disclosure?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I would believe it would be similar under 455A, since the standard is very similar to
Right.
too.
Typically, doesn't the judge then let the parties decide between themselves whether they're going to mutually provide for either waiver of the recusal or not make the recusal motion at that time, but one party is not put in the position of having to say to the judge, well, thanks for disclosing this, I'm going to let you out of here now.
In federal district court, though?
Yeah.
I'll accept
that
that's the process.
I'm asking as a question. I'm not making an assertion.
Well, he said he didn't know.
I don't know. I would assume that under 455A it's very similar.
Yeah.
But Campos does cite prejudice, and certainly prejudice when there is no clear grounds for actual bias, and appellant says we're not raising actual bias under the reasonably prudent person test as a member of the public. Given that it is a different test than for members, when appellant says I'm not raising actual bias, that goes towards as a factor finding that there is no actual implied bias. There is no implied bias or apparent bias. Knowledge of companion cases is clearly not partiality. Here, it's not extrajudicial knowledge. It's not personal knowledge. This is the only issue that appellant raised at trial as grounds for recusal. The military justice system would simply cease to operate if military judges could not try companion cases. And the testimony at trial, moreover, evinced that the junior Marines received non-judicial punishments because of appellant Lance Corporal Harvey, Corporal Reed, Corporal Marmoleo, Corporal Kalachnia. It's all on the record that they received non-judicial punishments because of appellant. Staff Sergeant Cadrillo's case is cited on the record. Both military judge and appellant agree in his Mayo 4 letter of convening authority that his appellant agreed that the military judge on the record agreed that appellant was much less culpable than Staff Sergeant Cadrillo. So with regards to the prejudice factor, that goes to show there's no prejudice, and it goes to show that the Staff Sergeant Cadrillo case was actually addressed on the record, as were the junior Marines cases, some of them at least.
Counsel, I'd like for you to go back for a moment to your argument about why this was or was not implied bias. Assume, for purposes of argument today, that the military judge's action in talking to the staff judge advocate was not permissible or at a very minimum was imprudent, and assume that you can't rely on the fact that the appellant's counsel did not make an actual bias claim. With those factors in mind, make your best argument as to why a member of the public would not perceive there to have been an injustice or implied bias here.
The conversation can be split into two parts. One is the statute of the Cabrillo part, and the second is the Lance Corporals, or the junior Marines part, that they shouldn't have been brought to special court martial, I guess, if you can divide into those two parts. With regard to the Staff Sergeant Cabrillo conversation, the explicit topic of the conversation was the junior Marines. Offhanded references regarding the differences in rank and culpability in rank is simply a common understanding in the military, that somebody who is more senior is more culpable than somebody who is less senior. It's just that's a factual description of the differences in responsibility. The First Circuit's Cruz Mercado case, which talks about the mafioso's comment, similarly, that's just a factual description, again, of the difference in responsibility.
And the judge said it was that, I thought they sold the case too low, given his culpability. What did they ask for in sentencing, Cadrill? What did the government ask for?
I'm not sure what they asked for in sentencing Cadrill's case, but I know that the judge gave 4 years.
We know they agreed on a PTA of 75 days,
yes,
right? But we don't know what they asked for. But presumably, is it in the record and you don't know, or is it not in the record, or you don't know?
I do not know whether it's in appellant's record, Your Honor, as to what they
asked for. Right, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, and that's another factor. Appellant here, if appellant's argument is that the pretrial agreement negotiations were somehow affected by the military judge's conversation, first of all, that's somewhat incredible, given the great disparity between, and that's another reason why the government claims that it's simply a factual description that the military judge was given in this case. The great disparity from 75 days to 4 years itself is reason for the convening authority then to say, I'm rethinking what I'm going to do with my pretrial agreement bargaining position. I'm going to do something different with appellant. That, number one. Number two, of course, because appellant came in last among the five appellants, or the five defendants, to bargain, his pretrial agreement bargaining position and power decreased as each defendant walked through the door. He was the last to go through the door. He got the worst deal. That makes sense. But nonetheless, again, with regards to prejudice, appellant got a fantastic sentence of only 90 days, all said and done.
Counsel, go ahead. Can we make anything of the fact that after the motion that the military judge recuse himself was denied, that rather than withdraw from the pretrial agreement and request trial by members, the accused elected to continue with trial before this military judge? Does that weigh in the law, or can it?
I think so, Your Honor, and I think that I believe that it's the Army case, the Davis case, that supports the suggestion that appellant going ahead with military judge trial alone, knowing that he presided at co-actors' trials without allowing them to recuse himself, is a factor to consider. So certainly, Your Honor, the fact that he proceeded with trial. I don't know if I finished answering your question about the – I don't think I finished my best argument. I think there's more to be made. May I continue with her question, Your Honor?
So, wait, are you arguing it's a factor, or that you're either stuck with a – in the view of the defense, an impartial – a partial judge – or you have to elect members?
I'm sorry, can you ask that again, Your Honor?
But it sounded a little bit like an argument that it's relevant that they didn't request a trial by members after his recusal motion was denied, and that bears on whether he was partial or impartial, or appearance issues. But then all of a sudden the accused is in a quandary of, I either have to pick members or choose what I believe to be as a partial judge. Is that really what you're saying?
I think that's a factor to be considered. If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, that he went ahead with trial.
But you're just using it as a factor. You're not putting too much weight on it, are you?
I'm putting some weight on it, Your Honor.
I'm asking how much weight. It's like an implied bias test, then, when you put it, you're mixing the full stew, then. You're not suggesting it's a dispositive factor?
No, Your Honor. It's all the facts and circumstances. That's one factor certainly to consider. And I think with Campos adding prejudice to the stew, I think in this case there simply is there is no prejudice.
What kind of stew is this anyway? Okay.
Appellant in this case cited no evidence that he tried to beat the pretrial agreement. this is kind of a reverse, I suppose, unlawful command influence motion. If he had said that he had submitted a pretrial demand and it was rejected because of this military judge's unlawful command influence on the staff judge advocate on the way to the convening authority, perhaps that would support his motion here. But again, it's, he stood up and said that I'm not suggesting that there's any actual bias in this case. And he got a pretrial demand for 15 months and finally received, again, 90 days. So, again, no prejudice in this case. Second part, not just the staff judge and Cadrillo comment, but the conversation with the staff judge advocate about the junior Marines, disqualification objectively was not required because of the comments about junior Marines for several reasons. One, of course, he never objected to the comments about the junior Marines. Even in his May 04 clemency matters, he simply talks about the discussion with the staff judge advocate as a discussion about Staff Sergeant Cadrillo's pretrial agreement cap. It's irrelevant what the military judge thought about the junior Marines, because whether he went to special court martial or not is irrelevant. Appellant went to general court martial. I think he was referred somewhere around 30 April 2003.
Why isn't it relevant to what a judge might give out on the sentence?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, he received a special court martial sentence, which is what he asked for in his May 2004 clemency matters. He received 6 months and a bad conduct discharge. So it is relevant, I suppose, in the sense that there is no great disparity between the sentences. There was a fair sentence adjudged in this case.
I thought I heard you say it was not relevant. His comments about junior Marines was not relevant.
Yes, Your Honor. His comment to the military judge,
it may not have been prejudicial, but it's certainly relevant to what someone might give out on sentencing.
But yes, Your Honor, there were junior Marines.
If you think a Marine NCO or staff NCO as a leadership role has failed his duty to be a leader, that's a comment about how harsh you might be to someone who's being sentenced who's failed as a leader.
I suppose that's one way to view it, Your Honor. Of course, his comment was that the junior Marines shouldn't have even gone to special court martial. If he thought that, appellant went to general court martial and he gave appellant a special court martial sentence, essentially, 6 months. So
I know, I'm not arguing with your prejudice argument. I'm arguing with your relevance argument.
Yes, Your Honor. But perhaps the wrong word. Perhaps that applies to prejudice.
Do you know what sentence the government and accused counsel requested, argued for at the court-martial?
I don't, Your Honor, in this case. Finally, I'll move on to the scolding of the appellant. Certainly, the scolding of the appellant is not grounds for partiality. If I may wrap up, I'll finish the scolding.
You can take the time that you need to finish the point you're making and to make a concluding point.
The scolding is not partiality. The Supreme Court has said as much. It was done concomitantly with the sentence being announced. There's no evidence that there's any prejudice, moreover, with the scolding comments at the end of the record. In closing, in this case, knowing all the facts, what the public is most likely to take up out of this case is that appellant pled guilty, that he was the last to plead guilty, that he conceded that the military judge had no actual impartiality, that after trial he commended the military judge for recognizing the difference in culpability between Staff Sergeant Cadrillo and himself, despite the fact appellant was the senior in position.
Senior in position because he was the kennel master?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no factual difference there.
Okay. Defense, Your Honor. Because the military judge properly declined to recuse himself, the government respectfully asked the findings and sentence be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Briefly, at trial, the appellant and his counsel argued for a punishment of no punishment. The appellant's counsel argued strenuously that the conviction alone was punishment in this particular case, given the mitigation that he felt he had presented during sentencing.
Also, what did the government ask for?
The government asked for 2 years, Your Honor.
And does this record reflect what the government asked for in the Cadrillo case?
This record is silent as to that point, sir. Briefly, to respond to the government's argument as to the actual bias, whether or not that was conceded by the defense during the motion to recuse, the record does not reflect that the defense at any point conceded that there was no actual bias.
Well, the counsel made clear that he was making the motion not under an actual bias basis, but on an implied bias basis, correct?
Exactly. The counsel was simply making clear that his motion relied on 902A, the apparent bias basis and not an actual bias basis. He was simply making the reasons for his motion clear. He never conceded that there was no actual bias. He simply stated, I'm not suggesting there is actual bias.
Well, if he thought there was actual bias, didn't they need to make a motion based on actual bias?
And I'm not arguing there is actual bias. I'm simply saying that it wasn't conceded at trial. And he was, and he certainly was not arguing actual bias. We're simply not conceding that there was no actual bias. We simply feel that, as the Civilian Defense Council apparently felt, that apparent bias is our stronger argument, and that is the argument we and not rely on an actual bias argument. Furthermore, as just to respond briefly to the government, again, as the government's argument of actual bias, that the fact that the council did not make a motion under actual bias, that that should be interpreted as to imply that recusal under the apparent bias standard was not required. The argument that the government urges upon this court would seriously undermine, if not completely vitiate, the purpose of 455 alpha and 902 alpha.
The government's arguing that, if I'm not mistaken, that it's one of a number of the totality of circumstances to be weighed. Did you agree with that, and it's just that you would put different weight on it, or are you making a distinctive legal argument that's different from the government?
The government's argument, it appeared to appellant, was that because the defense did not make an actual bias argument, that an objective observer, knowing that an actual bias argument or motion was not presented, from there could determine if there was no apparent bias. And that would undermine the purpose of 455A and 902A, which was the purpose was to deal with those situations where there was no actual bias, but there was an apparent bias in such in those circumstances, the public's confidence in the judiciary would be greatly undermined. If there are no further questions,
thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for the presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10 minutes before 10 o'clock this morning.
Court stands in recess until 9:50.